You're a SaaS founder. You've built something solid, but growth still feels harder than it should. Most SaaS companies don't fail because of bad tech. They fail because they've never become a must-have to the right customer. This podcast is here to change that. I'm Ton Dobbe, and this is the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. Every week, I talk to founders in the trenches, facing friction, making bold moves, and building companies that last. We dig into real choices around focus, positioning, customer pool, team alignment, the things that separate forgettable software from the ones that people can't live without. No hype, no hacks, just honest conversations to help you build something that people would miss if it was gone. If your SaaS should be indispensable but isn't yet, this is your podcast. Let's get into it. The guest on the podcast this week is David Bialon, CEO of Maïssa.
Whenever you have success, what you are going to hear is everyone saying how good you are. But if you act without that ego, without wanting to become something that you are not, everything looks much better. I know that this might not sound like the business kind of advice, but absolutely it's your worst enemy.
This is David. We dig into how he chose to build slowly when everyone else rushed, spending a year on foundation while others chase quick wins. You'll hear why he picked the hardest customers first, how he turned down expansion when everyone wanted in, and what happens when you position yourself to benefit from competitors' improvements. Well, hi, David. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. It's the first time I heard about your company and what you're doing, and I read what you're doing, and then I saw what others are writing about you, I was like, my God, this is one again. One of those companies that we might all remember in 10 years' time because, of what changed after that. So, delighted to have you on the call here. Before we start talking about your company, what drives you? You're young. I think you're driven. But what gives you energy as an entrepreneur?
It's indeed a very good question. What gives me energy at the end is that it's two things. I've always been lucky enough to be early to things. So I was early to Twitch. There is a streaming when it was called Justin TV. I was starting making YouTube videos in 2010. Same with a lot of other industries. And I've never felt that it was the thing until AI came 4 years ago when I started using it a lot. It started to feel right. And what drives me is I think that, personally, as in a personal matter, I have one main strength, which is vision. And once you see things, I feel a lot of responsibility over making sure that I give the best that I have to make sure that things go as well as it can for everyone. So what gives me energy is that I truly believe in what I'm making and what my team is making and what we are doing. And that's absolutely more than enough to push me every day.
Yeah. I mean, funny enough, when you mentioned that word responsibility, it immediately clicked with me of what I've been reading about you. First of all, about like all these black boxes of AI that you haven't got a clue what you're talking about, which is a form of unresponsibility, I would almost say. And what's happening there? And I saw your LinkedIn profile. I saw you positioning the company on the website and in general. That word sounds through there as well. You know, helping enterprise automate their most critical processes, which is bold, and with accountable digital workers. And I think that the word accountable is also all about responsibility. So fun.
It really is. I can tell you more about it if you want, but because thinking, so when you hear everything that is going to happen with AI and you put yourselves into the future and you think, okay, let's suppose that everything that it's been said is true, that we are going to get AGI and then ACI. And we have finally an AI that can do thousands of years of research for us in a matter of hours, and that we are indeed discovering the cure for types of cancer and for what would happen if we live in a world where we are given these presents, but we don't understand where they are coming from, because the machine that is telling us, it's we cannot trust it. Yeah. What I mean by that is that, yes, this seems to cure cancer. It's amazing. It's been an amazing discovery. But why we could not do it? What were we missing? And if you understand AI, you know that you cannot trust what it tells you, because it really does not have this conscious understanding of knowing what it's saying. You know, it's not conscious about really what it's saying as we are when we are speaking. So I had this feeling always of if in the future, if this is how things are going to happen, we will lose the complete meaning because we won't understand how things are done. And I might still know it, you might still know it, but maybe my grandson won't be able even to know it because he will get everything given. No? He will have everything by default. So I don't want to live in a world where AI is controlling everything and we cannot understand why and how. And I think that when the snowball gets bigger, this will be more and more into the people's awareness and attention that we really need to make this system accountable. For me, it's absurd that you hire people and you expect them to be accountable, and we are not doing the same with AI. And using it, and it's okay if it lies to us or if it has hallucinations. No, for me, it's not. It's really not okay. You have to have critical thinking. So that's why this kind of direction that the company and I also personally have, because I think that it's a major, major thing for us if you extrapolate this into the future.
Completely agree with that. Glad you're stepping up and actually solving that problem. Well, to make the bridge then to like who are you and what you stand for, you founded the business Maisa in 2023, so that's relatively short ago. It's amazing what you've already accomplished. But what was that problem that made you think, hey, enough is enough? If nobody's touching it, I'm going to do it.
The problem was trust.
Yeah.
And the problem was that it was first a technical problem. It's that we were trying to do use cases that in 2023, before this was founded in December 2023, January, we were trying to do use cases in the past company, my co-founder and me, and we were like, we kind of get them to work, but we don't know what they are not working. And that means that I cannot trust this because I am really not comfortable giving this to clients because I don't know if it's really going to work or not, because I don't know why is it failing. And we figured out that the main, from a first principle perspective, the main point that the market was doing was using AI to get responses and assuming that the responses were faithful. And we thought that that was a mistake because we both come from that place. So we decided to point it in a different way. We saw that AI was really powerful at pattern matching and predicting at the end the next token. So we thought, what can you trust? And at the end, people don't know about it, but you can trust the operative system that you have in front of you because it's executable code. So you can trace everything that has been made to the code that has been executed. So we thought that in the future, when you get AI that goes 500,000 tokens per second and it makes 1 year of work in 2 minutes, it's going to take more time for us to figure it out what it did and if it was well done than not. And if you don't trust it, you are already starting from a bad position. So we decided to use AI differently, not use it to get responses, but use it for it to tell us what needs to get executed, what needs to get done in order to get to the response. And from that very different perspective to approach it, we started scaling that idea. So we had the idea of making this reasoning engine, this kind of virtual computer in a way, and solving these inherent limitations of AI, the LLMs in this case. And that's how everything started, by simply visualizing the future and then pointing it that trust was going to be one of the main issues and that the hallucinations was a huge problem, lack of up-to-date data was a problem, and that we thought that the market was doing the wrong technical implementations to solve it, and which at that moment was we were called crazy, and with the that we were a very contrarian view of the market.
Yeah. And let's pause here because reading between the lines at the end, you're making a big attack to companies like OpenAI, Claude AI. I'm using that a lot these days. Perplexity, of course, is one, and everybody's starting to do these research modes, wherever they get it from. Gartner mentioned you as one of the few companies that is doing agentic AI in the right way, where the others are just pretending. So, if these big companies that everybody has come to know these days are doing it one way, what I hear is that you're doing it, the opposite way, with a far better results. Because also from the test, the reasoning what you're doing here is already beating them, and likely it's going to exceed all of them in a matter of months, likely. So what did you do different here?
What we do differently, it's that we first of all we use them. So that's really important. We decided that we didn't know that it wasn't good to fight with them. So
No.
because you need billions of funding and it's a completely different problem space which they are solving. So the first thing is acknowledge that they will keep improving. So you have to work in a product that improves with the market. And the second point is that because we don't have that vendor lock-in, that means that we are not Anthropic that needs to use Anthropic or OpenAI that needs to use OpenAI. We can use the best of breed for each thing that we want. We then need to understand that the market is moving also in different positions. You have them improving LLMs and multimodal. You have Google improving image generation and now even world models. You have companies like Eleven Labs improving audio. So the point was to position yourself in a point that you can compound the value of a market that is changing daily. So we decided that the best space to be was in the orchestration layer in a way. So you can compound the value and you don't directly compete with these models creators at this stage, I could say,
Sure.
but you could benefit from the market dynamics of accelerated improving. So what we are doing differently is that we are not focusing in let's make the model better or let's get these data sets and these huge costs, but let's try to understand what it's needed to make the user leverage this technology and solve the problems that they have. And that's how our product studio was created. Because you can hear today that people say, we have hit a wall after what has happened with GPT-5, for example, that there has been a lot of noise. But I think that that's not really true. Because first, we adapt really fast, and what used to be magic, today it's common. But secondly, it's not true that we have hit a wall. The technology is exponentially improving. The
Sure.
problem is that the technology is not what drives adoption. It's interface. You need an interface to interact with the technology. So focusing into the user experience that requires us to be able to extract the maximum value from this technology is something that we are also doing differently. We are focusing a lot on what it's needed to make the user comprehend what is this for and how it can be useful for them. And that's something related also to your point of that you cannot please everyone. You have to really understand who is that user, what do they need, what do they expect, where are they coming from. And that means that the problem space where we are positioning ourselves is very different. And we indeed do things like, yeah, we improve the tech, we make it trustworthy, faithful, reliable. But those are just the foundations where the value is created. That's when you
Yeah.
can then cross that bridge. So that's in a way also the different perspective that we have to this market
Yeah.
and the direction.
Well, I mean, let's pause again because you're saying a lot of things, and a lot of people will miss critical aspects of this when they listen to it too quickly. One of the things you said, and I think that's a fundamental thing that so many software companies do wrong. They think they have to build it all themselves. And then they bet on other companies to do the things that are not in their differentiation zone, but it's typically the things that are sort of almost at the edges of we would never build it anyway. But this is completely the opposite, you know, because these companies are actually like almost the hottest companies in the industry, and you decide, okay, let's leverage all of them, see which one is we don't know, we don't mind who's going to win. We're going to use them in a way that it starts to compound value for us. And I think that is a fundamental thought that people need to comprehend more in order to build better software at the end, because that is how the market is shaped these days, and how the half life of the product, I talked about that a lot, shrinking faster and faster and faster. And then to your point of making the bridge to how do you then make sure that you build the right thing? And you highlighted a trait from my book. Trait number one, by the way, remarkable software companies acknowledge they cannot please everyone. What has been that bet that you have started to focus on then, where you say, okay, hey, this is for this group with these characteristics, this is where we can make a meaningful difference.
So there is what we do fundamentally at the end is automating processes. So there has been this market, obviously, of RPA existing for a lot of years, and it's a multi-billion industry. But when you speak with the customers of that group, you easily detect that they are frustrated because they pay a lot. It takes a lot of time for them to do automations. The only things that appear in the market are what I call RPA 2.0, which is boxes with arrows, but now they put AI in the middle and they call it a agentic AI, which is not really what it is. And we detected that in that market, there was a space for a disruption because one of the main problems that this market has and that we have been focusing to doing is that the people that do the tasks are not enabled to automate the tasks. What I mean by that, the people that build the automations are technical people. They have zero clue about how to do, for example, accounting or so they need to book a lot of hours with the task doer, which are very busy, and try to model the process. And they spend 6 months developing, then figure out all the corner cases, bring them into a flow chart, try to code them again. And 1 year later, you have the use case, and the return on the investment is not anywhere because now the process has changed. And
Yeah, true.
what we saw is that there was an opportunity to empower these people to be controllers at the end of all of these automations, but enabling these task doers with natural language. So no flow charts, no drag and drops and things like that. Literally like onboarding a new employee, defining what the task it's about, and get the AI to work in a different direction. Instead of using it again to get responses, in this case, use it to interview the user. So, hey, I see that you want to do accounting. Are you going to be sending me Excel? So, do you want me to check or to check on a SharePoint if there's the file? I want that. Oh, okay. And do you want this to happen daily or how often do you do this? So it self-configured itself the worker for you, and that means that for these automators, now they can finally do all of the use cases that they always wanted to do and they weren't able to do it in the last wave of technology of RPA. But secondly, you open a new market of opportunities, which is the white collar jobs, and you are enabling these people that are the task doers, the ones that are in financials, in HR, in sales, to be able to create workers like colleagues that can help them to do the tasks end to end so they can dedicate the time to the things that they really love because they don't love to copy paste information from one Excel to another or to get 200 pages of PDF and put it on a CSV. So we got a lot of learnings by understanding those users and still are learning a lot because, once you solve this problem, what I can tell you is that new problems comes into the table that are needed to be solved to get to production.
I mean, it's almost impossible to get well to figure out where you have to stop because, like you say, you start in one particular area. In this case, from your website, it's already easy or easy to get. It's enterprise. It automates most critical processes, so that's already sharpening it. But how many critical processes are there? And they all have their own, specifics and particularities. And you gave the example of accounting, which is where I come from. Well, I mean, that could be like years of development in its own right. So how do you then decide with you have a small team, how do you decide where to focus and where not to focus?
In order to decide, what we did was understand the value that we were bringing, which was, in this case, as I say, trust. It's like the core value. And then you need to see which industries do value trust. And
Exactly.
you easily land into regulated industries. That's why they are regulated. because everything around those industries is about trust. So there you have banking, there you have energy, you have infrastructure, and you have, for example, manufacturing, supply chain management, automotive. So in those industries, a lot of if you solve finance for banking, you can use the learnings to solve finance for manufacturing. It might change. In banking, they might buy stocks and on some stuff, and in supply chain they might buy they might have pieces for a car, no, or for a t-shirt. But there is one thing that is that almost everything, like all of the knowledge, all white collar jobs follow very similar patterns. And really what changes is the stack of technology that is used and the know-how that is applied. What I mean by that, in all of these industries, and even you are doing it right now, all of us are doing more or less one similar use case that is absolutely very holistic, which is we receive information. It can be via an email, it can be via a task manager, it can be, but we receive information, which can be a PDF, an Excel sheet, a lot of PDFs, a lot of Excels, a piece of text. We consume that information with the know-how that we have. So we are doing accounting, you are doing it with that perspective. You are doing supply chain management, you are doing with that perspective. And then you or research in the system that you have for more information, or then use it and transform it to get or to a conclusion or to ping another peer or to move it into the next part of the value chain. This that I have told you has three components. What is the input? What is the know-how that you apply to that input and to the output that you want to get? And the application of that know-how, which is a combination of business rules and business logic at the end. And all of that, it's you can holistically create, which is what we have done, a platform that addresses that. And then what changes, again, is what do you connect it to and what is the know-how that you build. But that's why also we learned that boxes with arrows did not work, because you cannot modulate, for example, the sentence, when you are analyzing the PDF, do this. The concept of analyzing, it's something that you cannot really model with code by that, because it has a lot of things inside of it. So simplifying at the end, the way to focus is once you find the regulated industries, you find the use cases in the industry, you find the patterns that exist in the use cases, you learn from it, you focus in one customer, don't try to go for 10, focus in one customer, learn as much as you can from that champion in that industry that has given you the trust to work with you, and then go also to others with the learnings that you have and bring that and generalize towards other industries. And that's how, in my way, which is an horizontal play, you can start gradually growing horizontally, because you cannot go to everything at once. You have to be selective.
Let me make a small interruption here. David just made an excellent remark that sets his thinking apart from typical founders. He explained how focusing on one customer taught him more than chasing on 10 would. While others would celebrate the demand, users begging to open the platform to everyone, David recognized this was a distraction trap. He chose to stay narrow, learn deeply from enterprise champions, and only then gradually expand horizontally. The speed comes through focus, not through opening the floodgates. And this is what remarkable software companies do. They acknowledge they cannot please everyone. They aim to be different, not just better. And they offer something valuable and desirable. Want to master these traits as well? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
So that's why we have selected those industries, from those industries, specific departments. And then from that, we are growing now horizontally and bringing it to other industries.
Fascinating. And I mean, I agree with your approach, because that's the way to do it. And you made a critical point about, you know, what is the value you're bringing? Because a lot of times solving a particular problem is valuable, but for some it's more valuable than others. And that's where it gets critical. And you already mentioned trust. And that is connected to these industries that you talked about. One thing that got me going, because you used the example now of manufacturing, of accounting, the world that I came from, ERP, is of course one whereby, that's the technology that's always been used to automate those type of companies. How do you envision where you go with the company? Is it a platform that end user companies start to use, or is it a platform that's going to underpin the technologies that have always been available in those type of industries? So for example, SAP coming to you or Oracle coming to you and say, okay, hey, this is our next underlying platform to run, our functionality.
In the long term, how I envision in us growing, it's as a platform. And even a bit more than that, at the end, we are a platform already today, but a platform can be very generalistic. So I can tell you more about the vision that we have and that is related. We have a clear vision that is to become the number one employer in the world. And these employees are going to be not humans by itself, are going to be digital workers in our cases. And that means that we see the value that we are going to be bringing because companies are going to be able to loan or even integrate directly on their own premise the workers for the tasks that they have to do. Do you have a demand peak? No worries. You can serve it in the same day because you can onboard a worker ready to be used in the same day. You want to grow your business and are starting? Don't worry. You can go and hire these, start with these workers directly, which I think that will create a lot of value because that will not just accelerate growth by companies, but also will accelerate the creation of new companies and the expansion of the existing ones, which are large corporations. And the humans have a lot to do there because they are still going to be managing the corner cases, the moments when this did not work. And we will tell them it's one of the values of our platform. We tell you when it's not working something so you can put a human to review it proactively. And but the final goal is that we want the companies to be able to run their most critical operations, and not just the most critical operations, but their operations within MySA and in their cloud. So they don't have this lock-in or what if our website fails? Don't worry, this can be on-premise and you can run it as much as you want. But that's the vision that we have for this in the very long term.
Pretty inspiring. I mean, it reminds me of Microsoft at some point saying a desktop computer on every desk or a computer on every desk, and now it's become the number one employer. Well, I mean, it says something about the scale that you're going to operate at, because there's some way to go there. Then kind of moving from the acknowledge that you cannot please everyone, and I see the focus that you have, trait number one of my book. Then you talked already about offering something valuable and desirable, which is like connecting what you do with something that other people are prepared to pay for, prepared to pay a premium for. But before we started talking, you also highlighted another one, which is the third, aim to be different and not just better. How do you implement that inside your company? Is that something that is top of mind every single day? Because it's so easy to get into the trap of better. Whereby what I still see you're doing is, be radically different. And I see that in everything that I read about you. First principle thinking, challenge conventional wisdom, technical excellence over hype. Tell me a little bit more about it. Why did you pick this one as something that you believe is essential for your company?
Because when you live in a world of noise, which is what this is becoming, the only way to be there is by being different. Because everyone is claiming to be better and you cannot prove it, but you can always look for the different. The point there is that I think that I could tell you even from a philosophical perspective, better has it's very subjective. I can be better, and if I have benchmarks, I can tell you I'm objectively better. But that would be just constrained for the objective of the benchmark. For example, it can be a financial benchmark. I'm better doing benchmarks. But being better for me opens, it's way too broad. And at the same time, it's very subjective. You are not better because you say you are better. The market chooses who is the best option or the better option in a way or another. It can be because it has better distribution, so it's all in one platform, or it can be. So if you are different, it creates to you always the curiosity of what it's missing. And that what it's missing pushes you to see things out of the box and to see things of why it's everyone betting on this and why could it be wrong? And it's something that I really like to, I have always been a contrarian, and I always like to do that. When I see a trend, I'm like, why? You know, like, why is that the trend? And is there something there that might not work? And I can tell you why. Because if there is, that's an opportunity. And that's the way to find them. So that's why we try to be, we know we are different, fundamentally different, and we have grown towards that differentiation. And that's why on the long term, we know we will keep compounding, not just on the market, but also on our, on the things that makes us different. So if anyone wants to compete with us, they will have to be as different as we are in everything that we make. So now you are trying to copy me. And if you are trying to copy me, not good luck, but we have a vision and you have the copy of a vision. So it's I don't think that it's the same. So it's also a way to create a moat in a way, because it's very difficult to copy because you are not doing what it's written everywhere. You are doing what no one is writing about. And that gives you also an unfair advantage because you are the only one that know what you are doing internally. And I think that that's really, really, if you know how to play it, it's a really good advantage.
Exactly. That's also why it's number three in my book. And maybe it should have been one, but I thought it has a stacking order as well. And it can only come if you understand also that you cannot please everyone, because that's where you can get super concrete and get super deep in terms of what's really going on there and build something that is then suddenly different. One of the things that you highlight is very important, because a lot of people always think, okay, well, you need all this functionality. And as we have all this functionality, then of course it will start. And then we'll be different when it comes to how we market. But it's at the end of your approach to solving problems. That's where the difference comes from. And that is, well, between the four walls of your company in Valencia or San Francisco, it's the people, the brains together that go about the problem this way and not the other way. One of the things that I keep coming back and seeing about you is first principle thinking. Is that something that, how do you implement it in your company? Because it's a very underrated craft, I would say.
That's a very good question. I try to embrace it in everything. I think that a very good way of being first principle thinker is by questioning everything, which I don't think that it's bad. And secondly, by being very user-centric. And I can tell you how is that connected. It's because when you are user-centric, you are acting with, you must act with empathy. And if you act with empathy, indirectly, you are aligning yourself to the principles of the one that will consume you. And that forces you to question them or to find what it's missing in your perspective. I know that this might sound complicated, but the way I'm talking about tactics more than strategy or holistic, but if you are user-centric, so whenever you are doing something, you position yourself from the perspective of the user that is going to leverage your product, what you are doing indirectly, it's to position yourself in this... if you question it, and that's the point, you are like, why is this like this? What am I thinking about? You are gradually going towards the first principles. There are tactics like saying, let's do the five whys. And that leaves you, that bring you down also to the root. But that's also very difficult to do if you are not using empathy, because you are doing five whys through yourself and not through towards the user. So you will end up probably in a corner without a solution. That's how I embrace it through the company, because if you tell the people, think of first principles, they don't think how it is. And you need to find ways that they can embrace it indirectly, and it's and helping them to see whenever you approach a problem, use it with this perspective. Tell me who is the user, what is the use case, what is the pain point, what is he trying to do that cannot do, and how is the user going to speak about this to his mother, to his brother, and why? And then from that, go down and find out why. It's easier to say than to
do. It's a tough thing.
Yeah.
No, it is. But that's also why it's an art. I mean, this is actually, summing up chapter four of my book, Mastering the Art of Curiosity, because that is in essence what it's all about. It's this empathy that is super important. A lot of companies say that they are customer centric, but they couldn't care less. Yes, they have customers and they send them bills and they're nice to meeting those customers, but really go and sit down and do that, having that empathy and trying to really understand what's really going on beyond the first answer is a rarity. And the real value actually comes from there. But I saw, for example, that for example, yeah, you actually have been rethinking automation from the ground up.
Yes, it was an it's been a journey and it's still a journey. I tend to say internally also to the team, and we joke. I tell them we are in the 10%, five in the 10% of the product. The competitors are in could be even in the 2-3%. So, but what I'm trying to tell them is, guys, we don't know so much, and that I am talking right now, and I know that if we talk 1 year from now, I will tell you very different things because we are learning very fast, and that's also come from automation. Like on the automation topic, it's a very deep rabbit hole that if you enter into that, there are a lot of things to consider and to think about that could lead to also very large and profound conversations. Like, what do you do if and can you automate an economy? Can you fully automate an economy? And what it could mean? It's a post-abundance world. And what does it mean? How do you behave in a world where everything is automated? And why do we want to automate? Is it just cost reduction or what it's missing there? And I think that it's a very deep rabbit hole.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And that, of course, is also you run a business, something needs to come out that brings also, like that pays the bills. And one thing that I've seen also in one of your concepts is speed through focus. Can you give an example of that? I mean, maybe in connection to, okay, this is this problem we're trying to solve, to avoid that people go into rabbit holes and never come out again.
Yes. Yeah, one example. When I get users using my product from enterprises, they tell me, why are you not opening this for everyone? This is great. Why are you not opening this to everyone? This so everyone can enter. And I question myself this a lot of days. But then it's when the focus comes, when the trigger of, hey, remember to focus. Why? Because focusing into B2B is not the same as focusing into B2C. And focusing into enterprise B2B is not the same as focusing into mid-market B2B. And focusing into large regulated corporations B2B is not the same as focusing into B2B of large corporations. And it's very easy to get distracted by the potential that you could have,
Exactly.
but then you have to focus because you have limited capacity. And even if you hire people that increase your capacity, which doesn't mean that you have to increase your focus until you have not conquered, at least or you are the de facto winner over the first focus that you had. And it's very easy to get lost in the thread of, look how many PLG companies are making in 8 months 100 million ARR. Yeah. And who knows if they will be like that in 3 years from now? Maybe yes, and this is new dynamics. But in the path that I'm following, this is different. And if I now open this to everyone, then I will start receiving 100 tickets a day. And I will start receiving complaints about a product that won't be, and that's for me the key, aligned with the needs of the users that I'm serving in my main focus. So then I will have to distract my capacity and my resources. So
Exactly.
that's a real example of how I think that you can speed by focusing. That is saying no to a lot of things that you really want to say yes. And even your intuition tells you, you should say yes, but at the end are just behind of it. This is a bit profound, but it's motivations of ego of you wanting to be what everyone is telling you that you have to be when you might have another path, and that
Yeah,
only
exactly.
focus gives you that way.
True. And it's often also, yeah. To me, it's not always about, okay, saying no. It's about saying no, not yet. And I think that's also parking it because, yeah, at some point there will be time for it, but not now. And I think that is easing a lot of minds. What I also see is that, well, the more the company grows and you get involved with people from the outside world, maybe investors, maybe your board. I mean, they all are opinionated and they all have their thoughts about where this company can grow. And they all have their expectations about your growth as well, which is making it even harder. So where do you go for those crucial decisions? Also realizing that you don't know everything.
I speak with my co-founder whenever we have decisions like this. I look at the data. So what does the data say? What data points do we have to make a decision? Based on the data points, what hypotheses do we have? What things do we have on the table? What possibilities do we have? What is our vision and the objectives that we have to cover? And what are possible tactics that we can execute to get there? And one thing that when you are executing at the speed that we are trying to execute and that we've been executing, there is also a lot of intuition. And I know that this might sound, but it's being able to listen to your intuition and to and a lot of people maybe won't tell you this, but really listening to your intuition, which if it's aligned with the objectives, a lot of the times, surprisingly, it's quite right if you are very aligned and focused and into what you are making. But you need this side, and you also need the other side, which is the quantitative data that can help you make a strong decision. And that's really what how usually we make these decisions, and also listening a lot. I mean, as a CEO in my case, and as a decision maker, it's by always I am always in a position when I don't know if I am right. So I try to listen and join dots and hear other of my team's perspective that are much better than me at everything that they are doing. And
Sure.
that's how you do it.
Yeah. And take advantage of that. I mean, I go back to your first point about finding those around you that compound your value, which I think
Yes.
is applicable to people as well. It's not only the technology that compound the value of your solution, but it's also the people that you compound around you.
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. Like a company, it's a reflection of the team, and you need to. If you don't have the team, and they are not better than you, then what do you know? What do you have it?
A
You
lot of
should
people
always
are
look.
afraid of this, you know, hiring people that are smarter than them. But it all depends, of course, like how you organize it. But I got one more question on that particular point. You've mentioned vision a couple of times now, and I think vision is like the essential thing that can guide a lot of these difficult decisions, as long as the vision is crisp enough. Because you gave the one liner, likely there's more behind it. Have you gotten your, for example, the mission that is connected to your vision? Have you also got sort of the first principle or holistic principle guide, like guardrails for people to make the decisions for themselves on a day-to-day basis, rather than having to go to their boss all the time?
The way to get to the vision that I told you before, in our way, it's to make AI accountable. That's our mission. So everything that the team is making, also in a point, they have to ask themselves, are we making AI accountable? Which means, are we delivering trust data points to the user that they can feel more confident when using this functionality, this point, this tool, this journey, this use case? Because I think that is what it's going to lead into the vision that I have. Because if that doesn't exist, my vision doesn't exist. Like the vision doesn't exist.
The value doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's what I told you at the beginning. Could you trust an employee that it's not accountable? That makes the world and it's not responsible? No. So how are you going to be the number one employer if no one trusts your employees? So if you make your employees the most accountable, what you are creating, and also it's very challenging, it's that's not just from a business perspective very sticky. You are really creating a company that makes people feel safe in the sense that it's trust, that they can go to sleep knowing that that's not a worry for them because that's working. And that's the mission that we have. That goes beyond of that, obviously. The mission leads us to the vision and everything is connected, as you say, but that's the path that we get towards the and why this is the mission of what we have always this into the table.
Yeah, smart. Yeah, and that also creates so much speed in an organization. Like even having those checkpoints, like this is what I want to do. Does it check this point and that point? And if yes, you likely should be doing it. And then of course you have to balance in terms of resources, but at the end, makes it a lot easier. Last question then. I mean, you're a young entrepreneur, and but you. You've also learned a lot in a very short time. What will be a do and what will be a don't that you would like to share with other yeah, entrepreneurs that are aspiring what you're building here?
In the go-to, what I probably could say, it's whatever it is, do it. Let me rephrase this. We spend more time planning than doing, and we spend more time figuring out how it will be than doing. So the best way to know is do it. So you have this idea, do it. But really do it. Like, you don't know how, go to do it. Go try. What you don't know, go for it, and you will discover. Because if not, it's you always are looking at the you are like go you have a mountain and you are choosing the path. Go and try to go to that mountain, because you will discover in the middle that there was another path and that you got a learning and you found that there was a village and a lot of people want to buy in that village and you are coming with everything they are looking for and you didn't know that. So that is related to when I say do it, do what if it's something that you hate, you are not going to do it. That's also one of the points. It's something that you will feel that ignites this. It's 2 a.m. I have this idea. So I woke up from the bed and I went to the computer because I needed to put that down. No? So my go do for me would be do it. Like literally, go for it. And the don't do it's maybe it's helpful, but I don't want to get too philosophical, but don't listen to your ego. Whenever you have success, what you are going to hear is everyone saying how good you are, which might be true or not, but who cares? Because that's a matter of perspective. And the ego is going to every time put you in a defensive position in that I'm doing a bad job, in look how the competitors are doing, in like why it's going to question yourself every time. But if you act without that ego, without wanting to become something that you are not, everything looks much better. I know that this not, might not sound like the business kind of advice, but or suggestion, but
It is.
absolutely, it's your worst enemy.
Exactly. Completely
Avoid
agree.
it.
Well, yeah, I mean, the perfect words to end this with. Just start, just yeah, go do it, and don't listen to your ego. I mean, it's but people start doing that, a lot of weird things happen, and don't, you know, just stay in the zone where you can deliver your best value, regardless of what people think of you. Where can people go to find out more about Maisa, or to say hi to you?
It's mesa.ai, and to say like literally there, if they send something in contact, I will read it 100%. I read everything that comes to this company, so they can reach us through contact, or if not, in my LinkedIn or X, David Villalon or David Parr in X, whatever they want. But I'm quite reachable.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And good luck on the rest,
Thank you.
well, on the next years on the journey.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
And this wraps up my conversation with David Bialon, CEO of Maisa. If you got value from this episode, please share it with other SaaS founders who need to hear this as well. And if you got 10 seconds, a quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts will help more people to find these conversations. Thank you for listening to the Remarkable SaaS podcast. If you want more insights like this, subscribe to my daily email, Espresso with Ton. It's a 2-minute shot of clarity for SaaS founders who want to create pull, not push. You can sign up, along with getting my book, at valueinspiration.com. See you in the next episode.